Morning. Hi. So, if you saw your programs, you see that I'm talking this morning about the koan in Soto Zen, and this is going to be a little bit redundant for people who are in practice period, but not very redundant, a little bit. So the koan in Soto Zen. So first of all, this is Soto Zen right here. We're the Soto Zen school. That's our practice, the Soto Zen school. And there's also the Rinzai Zen school. And the main difference between the two schools is the way they use, the way they deal with koans. K-O-A-N. Koan. K-O-A-N. And the Rinzai school, which some of you have studied in, or you studied in amalgamations of Rinzai and Soto, because there are amalgamations, use the Kosoku koan. The Kosoku koan is their main thing. And the Kosoku koan is based on ancient paradigms that took place during the Tang Dynasty in China, between 600 and 900, encounters between teachers and students, or teachers or students, but usually teachers and students. And they seem nonsensical on the surface, but there's some truth to them, some deep truth to them. In the 10th century, when the Rinzai school really got started with Lin Chi. It got started with Lin Chi, who was a little earlier. They began packaging the koans. They began packaging them, and they packaged them in different books. And so they were packaged then for meditation, for zazen. And of course, in Soto we study them too, but they're not the focus of our meditation. We look at them, we talk about them, we think about them, but they're not the focus. So that's why we're not the Kosoku Zen school, we're the Genjo Zen school, the Genjo Koan Zen school. And Genjo is about daily life. The problems, the difficulties that come up in daily life are ample to bring them to our cushion. And to just be with them. They're ample. We don't need anything else, anything more. Although it's neat to study those, and when we study those, we can see how actually they may not be at all different from what we're going through at a fundamental. They're probably not. But so our attitude's a little different. And Dogen, who is the founder of Japanese Soto Zen. Soto Zen starts in China, and then Dogen sort of brings it into Japan and modifies it. His approach is that we, rather than looking for a solution to the problem, whatever it is, the difficulty outside, we bring it into our hearts. We bring it into our hearts. We bring it into our breathing. We bring it into our sitting. We bring it into our body. We become close to it. We don't force ourselves to become close to it. We just let it come close to us. So that instead of churning it over and over again, thinking and analyzing it over and over again, it comes closer and closer and closer. And as it comes closer, it loses its scary power. It loses its but it does it on its own in Genjo Koan. It doesn't do it according to some system. There's no system. It's just your own system, your own life, your own psyche. So that's the approach in Soto Zen. And when we look at of course, koan didn't. Well, the term wasn't even used until about 900. So, what about early Buddhism? Were there any koans in early Buddhism? Well, look at Buddha's life. Buddha spent his 9 years sitting and trying different things because he had an issue, right? He had an issue. his issue was there's this suffering all around him, which, according to the myth, which is sort of a ridiculous myth, he didn't discover until he was in his mid to late 20s. That's a very interesting myth. All of a sudden he saw all the suffering that his parents had sequestered him from. I don't think so. But anyway, that's the story. But so that became his, he was so shaken by that suffering, and then so enamored of the fourth person he saw, which was the sannyasin, the beatific sannyasin, who was just able to be in it all and not be, that he, then his difficulties, 9 years of practice, difficult practice, were to, what is this? Can I manifest this myself? Can I? And he had to do it by letting all his own suffering come close to him. Come closer and closer and closer. And his techniques he used in the first few years kept it away. But ultimately, he had to let go of those techniques. If you look at his life that way, and I think there's a valid scholarly treatises that support that. But we don't know for sure. We don't know. So call on, right? Call on. Call means oneness. On means separateness. Call on, oneness and separateness. Call oneness on, Shohaku calls, keeping to one's own lot. I don't get into your lot. I stay in my lot. You stay in your lot, and we'll get along. I start messing in your lot. Well, I don't know. I don't know. So call on. Two aspects of reality. And as our practice matures, we realize that actually there's only one koan as our practice matures. And that's how to live at the intersection of oneness, jeez, oneness with all of life, and individuality, separateness, contingency. And that's sort of a lifetime koan once our practice gets mature. Whatever that means. Don't literally believe in that either. Well, you know. Then we start evaluating, right? So the oneness side is what attracts most of us to Zen. There are a few people who might be attracted by the on side, the separateness side, but that would be unusual in this culture. That would be very unusual. Yeah, I think so. If we did a show of hands, I wonder how many would raise their hand about being attracted to the separateness side, the individual side. So the oneness side. So the first rendition I read of oneness in my book here, which I still have and is falling apart, by Arthur Koestler, which I am going to read to you. I read it to myself in whatever year that was, before I began Zen practice. Let's see if I can find it. Arthur Koestler. Some of you know Arthur Koestler? Raise your hand if you know Arthur Koestler. Arthur Koestler was, when he wrote this, he had been a prisoner in the Spanish Civil War in jail. He'd been doing his retreat. It was a forced retreat. Everybody who gets ordained by me has to do a month retreat. But Arthur Koestler was forced into his retreat. And they didn't hurt him. They gave him plenty of food and water. He only had four walls. And he didn't get to take any books with him. And so here he was on retreat. Okay. I was standing at the recess window of cell number 40. And he had a hanger, and he was trying to scratch some mathematical proofs into the wall, because math was something that helped him with his sanity. And he tried scratching it in. I want to recall Euclid's proof that the number of primes is infinite. And then for the first time, I suddenly understood that the infinite is arrived at by precise and finite means. The infinite is a mystical mass shrouded in haze, and yet it is possible to gain some knowledge of it without losing oneself in treacly ambiguity. The significance of this swept over me like a wave. The wave had originated in an articulate verbal insight, but this evaporated at once, leaving in its wake only a wordless essence, a fragrance of eternity, a quiver of the arrow in the blue. I must have stood there for some minutes, entranced, with a wordless awareness that this is perfect, perfect, until I noticed some slight mental discomfort nagging at the back of my mind. Some trivial circumstance that marred the perfection of the moment. Then I remembered the nature of the irrelevant annoyance. I was, of course, in prison and might be shot. But this was immediately answered by a feeling whose verbal translation would be, "So what? Is that all? Have you got nothing more serious to worry about?" An answer so spontaneous, fresh, and amused, as if the intruding annoyance had been the loss of a collar stud. Then I was floating on my back in a river of peace, under bridges of silence. It came from nowhere and flowed nowhere. Then there was no river and no eye. Ah, the eye had ceased to exist. Whether the experience had the eye had ceased to exist. When I say the eye had ceased to exist, I refer to a concrete experience that is verbally as incommunicable as the feeling aroused by a piano concerto, yet just as real, only much more real. In fact, its primary mark is the sensation that this state is more real than any other one has experienced before, that for the first time the veil has fallen and one is in touch with real reality, the hidden order of things, the X-ray texture of the world, normally obscured by layers of irrelevancy. Whether the experience had lasted for a few minutes or an hour, I never knew. In the beginning, it occurred two or even three times a week. Then the intervals became longer. It could never be voluntarily induced. After my liberation from prison, it recurred at even longer intervals, perhaps once or twice in a year. By that time, the groundwork for a change of personality was completed. So there's the first thing that I read when I was a young man about oneness, and it really brought me to Zen. It was right from there, right to Zen. So with that, why do we need on? Why do we need individuality? Wow, who wants individuality? Individuality sucks if you can have this, right? Be frank. Be candid with yourself. But on is very important. Individuality is very important. Zen meditation is the instrument for manifesting oneness. It's the primary instrument. But there's the individuation side. There's the individual side. In the oneness side, he let go of all of his stories. Wow, we can let go of all of our stories. Possible. Those stories that we rehearse over and over again. How many times? How many iterations? How many versions? Isn't 30 versions enough? By the 30th version, can't you say, okay, I'll move on to it? But no. No, not us human beings. No, 30 versions isn't enough. Because she doesn't get my version. And I gotta get it, etc. You know, etc., etc. He doesn't get my version. Understand my version, please. You're my partner. Listen, etc., etc., right? Etc., etc. So, on individuality, we are storytelling beings. We live through stories. The individuation side means that we have dysfunctional stories that come from our childhood. We all do. You don't have to be a smart psychologist. Even a stupid psychologist knows this. Even someone who's been in therapy for 10 minutes knows this. We all have stories that are dysfunctional from childhood in this culture. I've never lived in another culture. I can't say about these other cultures. They seem, you know, they're different. Maybe they're different. I don't know if they're different. We have these stories about dependency, about inability to deal with conflict, about being tiny and the big people are messing with our worlds. We have those stories, and we carry them with them. So individuation with us, individuation on, is getting in touch with those negative stories, those self-defeating stories, and replacing them gradually. Not just dissing them, but gradually replacing them with stories of well-being, of health, of love. And that's a process that you're not going to be able to do by sitting facing a wall entirely. Unless you're a miracle person. Maybe you're a miracle person. But not very many people can. Not very many can. These are dealing with our stories that are wounded, that are inadequate, and changing them into healthy stories requires a lot of work, a lot of effort. And it's not generally on the cushion. It complemented by being on the cushion. It could involve therapy, could involve 12-step programs, it could involve peer support, it could involve just having a buddy, just one buddy. All you need is one buddy. But that stuff is very, very important, I think. Very, very important. My wife and I have been married for 44 years. Wow, I'm old. 44 years, imagine that. I can remember when I thought, those 44-year-old people, they're really out of it. Now I have been married for 44 years? 44 years. And last summer I said to Linda, we need to get into therapy again. We need to get into therapy. We're going over the same old stories. We're trying to convince each other again that whose version is right, which is the correct version, which is the more loving version, which is the more generous version. We need to get into therapy. She said, what? And we hadn't done it for 25 years. I said, yeah, look at it. Look how stuck we are. Stuck. We get stuck. We get fixated. We can sit facing a wall for 32,000 years doing the same stories over and over again. And we say, oh, we're going to have Arthur Koestler's experience. Sure, you can have Arthur Koestler's experience, but I want to tell you something about Arthur Koestler. If you read about his life, the rest of his life he was an asshole. He was an asshole. He had this one experience, and then he never individuated. He never worked on his own issues. His childhood issues, his issues of feeling a victim and needing to victimize people, stayed with him till he died. And if you've read his life, you know that. You know that. He didn't take care of the on part. He didn't take care of the on part in the koan. So why am I talking about this today? Well, a few of you know why I'm talking about this today. I'm talking about this today because I was introduced a few months ago to Sweeping Zen online. Sweeping Zen. And I was only introduced to it because I don't really go online, because the guy called me and told me he'd like to do a piece on me. And I thought, oh, well, what's Sweeping Zen? He said, well, I want to do a piece on you. So then I had to look it up, right? Well, lately, Sweeping Zen has been about the last week to 10 days. It's almost been a sordid psychodrama about victimization of students by teachers. Power victimization and sexual victimization. And students' collusion in that. Because it takes two to tangle. It takes two to tangle. Finally, the guy who did this, Adam Treby, yesterday, the day before, he said, enough! If you're following me, he said, enough, I'm not doing this anymore. He said, we've got to move on. Because people, there are so many feelings in spiritual communities around the country about hurts as a result of teachers taking advantage of students. Or we could say students allowing them to themselves. I think it's 80-20. I think it's 80% the teacher's responsibility, but it's 20% the student's responsibility. 20%. It takes two. This is all about, and I haven't read Scott Edelstein's book, so he's coming to speak here, Sex and the what? Sex and the Teacher? Stuck, Sex and the Spirit. I haven't read his book, so you should come hear him. And then I'll read it before I come, so I won't be so stupid. But this is all about spiritual bypassing. If we just focus on the call, if we just focus on the undividedness, it's a term that was coined by John Wellwood in 1980. I was at Naropa Institute in 1980, and I took a course from John Wellwood, and he had just coined the term. He was a psychologist and also a student of Trungpa Rinpoche's. Talk about boundary violations. Talk about victimization. Wow. Big time. Big time. He defined spiritual bypassing then, and he still defines it, as using spiritual practice to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. Using spiritual practice to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. Which means we think we can rise above the raw and messy side of our lives. We can rise above it through Zazen. We can cleanse ourselves of it through Zazen. Yes, we can cleanse, but we cannot rise above. This rise above thing is our idealism. And Krishnamurti once said that idealism, clinging to idealism, is the most severe form of violence. Most severe form of violence to self and other. You can see why, can't you? So anyway, we need to work on our developmental issues too. There's plenty of time to do both of these things in our lives. Plenty of time. And Dogen says, a bird flies in the sky, and no matter how far it flies, there is no end to the air. That's the oneness side. Flying in the sky, one with all the sky. No beginner's mind, no sense of before or after, just flapping the wings, not knowing where you are. You're the whole thing, and you don't even think it. You're just flying. And then Dogen also says, and the bird totally experiences its realm. So in oneness, when our mind is completely still, beginner's mind, we totally experience, and there's no comment. There's no comment. On the other hand, if the bird leaves the air, it will die at once. If we don't take care of our individual needs and our relationship with this air that we're breathing right now, and the way our lungs are working, we'll die. We'll die. So, the deal is, then, two tracks, right? Humans becoming Buddhas. Oneness. Like Arthur Koestler did for those few minutes. Too bad he didn't have a Zen teacher. Would that have made the difference for him? Would that have made the difference if he had had Suzuki Roshi after that? What if he had a Zen teacher who was abusive? Anyway, so humans becoming Buddhas. That's our aspiration. Our aspiration is to... And what is a Buddha? A Buddha is just a person who's awake, who lives wakefully. That's all. It's not some... We're becoming Buddhas. We want to live wakefully. We don't want to be transfixed by those stories over and over again. We want to let go of that transfixion so we can be available to each other, right? So we can be available to this wonderful unfolding life. Winter, summer, spring, fall. It's the same wonderful unfolding life. So we want to be Buddhas. But we are also Buddhas learning to be human. We have to be Buddhas, human, learning to be human, or we miss it. We miss it. And we just stick to one side. Forming and sustaining healthy attachments. Healthy attachments. Attachment's not a dirty word in American Zen. Please, don't make it a dirty word. Healthy attachments. We all have to form. So, when those of us who have psych background studied developmental psychology, we learned about how important it is to form attachments when you're growing up. And we learned about something called attachment avoidance. Kids who don't form healthy attachments, what happens to them? They become attachment avoidant. And they think they're just sort of making it on their own. And they are, they have to, but it's because they're afraid. They're afraid to reach out. They're afraid to look at their stuff because they don't trust the world because they couldn't trust big people. They couldn't trust big people, so how can they trust anybody? So they're attachment avoidant then for their whole lives. Well, of course, with therapy, with 12-step groups, with peer support, you can modify that in a major way. In a major way. So when we have both the person who has the spiritual authority, whether it's in the Catholic Church or the Lutheran Church or the Zen Center or the, I don't know, academia, the person with authority and the person who doesn't have authority doing spiritual bypassing, then you're going to have some yucky stuff happen. It's inevitable. Yucky stuff is going to happen. Not nice, not compassionate, not loving, not caring. It's going to happen. And why doesn't the community do something about it when these kinds of things happen? Why don't the community? Well, sometimes the community doesn't know. But usually the community does know something. Usually they can feel something. But why don't they? Because they too are carrying around their own wounds, and they're not transparent about them because they don't want to be seen as needy. People here don't want to be seen as needy. I mean, look at Zazen, you know. How much Zazen will you do on your commitment sheet? Will you stay for the whole retreat? You have to come meet with Tim. And before recently, I was, you know, I was always here. Now that my health's not so good, maybe people will relax a little bit. You know, so they don't want to be needy. You don't know. I'll be needy, but not at Zen Center. You know, everything is done a certain way. We're still. We sit without moving. I saw Ben scratch his nose once, and that was a no-no, but nobody else in the room would dare scratch their noses. Right? We don't want to be perceived as needy. So that's one reason we don't talk. We're not open. We avoid the on side, the honest boundary keeping and boundary setting and boundary maintaining and boundary appreciating side. A second reason we do it is that our spiritual practice gets way ahead of our human development. This is what happened to Arthur Koestler. Wow. I was jealous when I first read this. The guy didn't even have to do anything except go to jail. And so his spiritual practice, his spiritual opening was way above anything he did developmentally, psychologically. So he never thought he had to do a thing psychologically. Woo-woo! I mean, why would he? Woo-woo! Everybody was impressed. Not to say the least, him. And the third thing is that we know in spiritual communities, and I hope Zen Center is not like this, although Zen Center must have been like this at some point because we had our own history. We have our own history of a teacher taking advantage of a student. Maybe more than one student. I wasn't around. I've heard so many stories. I can't say, but this is our history. It was in this building. It was in this building. And I had been around. For some reason, I just left before that. I think I left before that phase. Well, I'm not even clear about that. Because I never got the narrative details. But it happened here. It could happen here again. And why don't people say the emperor has no clothes in these spiritual communities? Why didn't they at San Francisco Zen Center? Why didn't they at Los Angeles Zen Center? Why didn't they with Ado Roshi in Zen Society of New York? These are the big Zen centers. These are where the major teachers are, the teachers who are really know how to do oneness and supposedly know how to do the on part too, supposedly know how to be in the world with good boundaries too. So why did this happen? Why does this happen? Because it's scary to say the emperor has no clothes. It's scary. It's only that one little kid would do it in the story, right? He had nothing to lose. He didn't know he had anything to lose. You say it in a spiritual community where everybody's tight, everybody's working on this goal, everybody's trying to be good, and you get ostracized. Or people, whoa. So those are three reasons that it doesn't happen. But we can have healthy communities too. I hope this is a healthy community. I hope so. But it takes work. It takes work on the on side, but also on the on side, on the individuation side. You know, my friend, whom I'll call George, started practicing here with me in the late 70s. Mid-70s, we started practicing here. Mid-70s, yeah. My friend George practiced here for a long time. Then he told me he had, his name's not George, you guys, but some of you might be able to figure out who he is. Then he told me that he was leaving Zen Center. I thought, oh, that's too bad. I'm going to miss you. And he said, yeah, you know, I've been drinking beer. I've been drinking too much beer. You know, I've been drinking beer every day, Tim. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. Well, a beer or two? He said, no, I've been drinking more than a beer or two of every day. I said, well, you're always here for sitting, and you always, you know, did this. He said, yeah, well, I did the beer, too. The beer helped me get through those long sits. I thought, wow, where did he have the beer, you know? and so he went into AA. My friend George, I talked to him last month, and this was in the 1980. He still got four groups a week he goes to. Four nights a week he gets support. He's got a huge support network of friends. And I used to feel jealous. I used to think, geez, maybe I should drink. then I really get a support network. Look at all the support all the support people George has. He's sponsor for all these people. All these people sponsor him. He's okay to be needy. In fact, it's, you know, you're frank, they're open, they're transparent about it. Now George is back to doing meditation again. Now he's back to doing meditation again. And I feel so happy about that. So happy about that. So from the oneness point of view, from the cold point of view, from the enlightenment point of view, from the emptiness point of view, all of our stories are just made-up stuff. They're just made-up stuff. And you could even say they're lies, although that is a little harsh. A little harsh. But I don't know. They're lies. Why not say that? Because they're fabrications, right? They're fabrications. And we lose so much sleep over them. We lose so much psychic energy over them. We lose so much that we need to practice zazen. We need to do zazen. On the other hand, storylessness can lead to alienation and depression. Storylessness can lead to alienation and depression. Storying is how human beings make the world, how we create our world. And we can develop stories that take care of our developmental needs, that take care of our needs for good, healthy boundaries that are permeable, for intimate love relationships, for confidently dealing with issues without having to use some kind of compensatory identity that is a good Zen student or doesn't, or whatever this goes on. I don't exactly understand this. Not that I haven't been part of it, I just don't exactly have a handle on it. Communities are rooted in shared histories, rooted in shared stories. Well, that's wonderful. And how can we do this and still be light about our stories, still realize that from the cult point of view, our stories are just made up. But still, they're wonderfully made up. They're made up to connect ourselves to ourselves and to each other. And by working on those stories and being with those stories that are inadequate and changing them, we can have good stories, and then we can let go of those good stories in Zazen. But then come back to them and let go of them. Come back to them. That's the intersection of call and awe, and the intersection of oneness and separateness. And not that that's easy. That's learning to relax in ambiguity. Learning to relax in the middle of tenuousness, because, you know, there's both the oneness and there's a separateness. And how are we going to manifest both? How are we just going to relax into it? See that they're both the same thing, and yet they're different. So I'm going to finish with a poem by Dogen. The Western Patriarch's doctrine is transplanted. I fish by moonlight till on cloudy days. Clean, clean, not a worldly speck falls with the snow. As cross-legged in this mountain hut, I sit the evening through. Okay, so the Western Patriarch's doctrine is transplanted. So that's Bodhidharma, who brought Zen to China, transplanted in now in Japanese soil, he's saying, now in American soil. We're transplanting it. We're just starting to make this transplanting. We have only been doing it for 50 years. And so we've messed up. But that's okay. You mess up when you're trying to transplant something. It's new soil. It's different soil. But it's the same plant. They're the same seeds. And we have a great opportunity in the second 50 years to do plant those roots deeper, take care of both the undividedness and the separation. And I think we're doing fine. I think we're doing fine. I don't think we need to beat anybody up. Especially ourselves or our poor teachers. They were doing the best they could too. We all, at some point in our lives, felt small and inadequate. And we carry that with us, even as we're teachers. And we do then compensatory identities. We all do that, even teachers. So if we can see that, if we can see that, if we can be affiliative and have peers and have give and take, and then we can let it all go during Zazen, that's cool. But we don't know how to do it. It's ambiguous. We don't know how. There's no technique. We just have to do our best. So, the Western Patriarch's doctrine is transplanted. I fish by moonlight till on cloudy days. So when he fishes, it's by moonlight. He can barely see the water. He can barely see the fish. He doesn't know where to put in his pole. The moonlight's shimmering on the water. He can't tell what's the fish and what's the moonlight because of the shimmering. That's our lives. We're fishing by moonlight. We never know. We never know. But the moonlight is always there. It's always penetrating. But we don't know. Are we going to catch a fish? Are we really doing a good job? Are we going to hurt another being? Take care of the separateness side. Take care of the unresolved issues side. So we don't hurt another being, please. And we're also always tilling on cloudy days. That's when we're tilling. We want to till on a sunny day. But always the rain is going to come. We get a little tilling done and then it rains. And the clay soil we have in Minnesota, oh, we have to start all over again. We're always tilling on cloudy days. This is the human condition. You can't transcend this. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry at all. It's cool. It's cool. When we just go into it, it's cool. It's what is. It's what is. Ambiguity, uncertainty, transiency. Don't know, don't know, don't know. The Western patriarch's doctrine is transplanted. I fish by moonlight, till on cloudy days. Clean, clean, not a worldly speck falls with the snow. As cross-legged in the mountain hut, I sit evening through. At the intersection of oneness and separateness. And if we've lost that intersection, all we have to do is come back. Come back. Because that's what it is to be human. So that's what I want to say today, you guys. And be glad to entertain questions, comments, stories, songs. Even songs. Yes, even songs. Whether you can carry a tune or not. This is beginner's mind practice, right? Oh.
Tim.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could, what your thoughts are in, with this kind of modern psychology thinking, what your thoughts are in relation to kind of the Chinese tradition, monastic, specifically hermit.
Yeah.
And kind of leaving the dusty world and not dealing with these kind of like social, psychological problems at all, but completely going into the oneness undivided.
Yeah, it's a huge question. I don't know if I'm prepared to answer it. One of the reasons I'm not prepared to answer it is that I didn't grow up in that kind of a culture. Do you want to try to answer it? I'm not saying you have to. I just
I haven't thought about it much myself until you gave this talk. So, but the one thought that came to mind was that the psychology, the on individual side, is more in regards to socialization. So if you're a hermit living, you know, granted you don't have a lot of kind of fear and psychological problems going in, but you don't have to worry about as much as, I mean, that's the point of leaving the dusty world. So so there's an opportunity if you have the ability to take that dive, to kind of leave that all behind, and it seems like that's the intention.
And I think that's wonderful, but as a Western psychologist, and I'm speaking now as a Western psychologist, I'm suspicious. I'm initially suspicious. I think I just want to make sure that the person who does that has worked through their attachment issues already. Or I think their hermit, I think their hermit-like experience is not going to be so wonderful. It's going to have lots of sort of unhealthy stuff attached to it. That's what I... But that's a, speaking as a Western psychologist, I need to be careful. I never lived in Chinese cultures in the year 900 or 1200. So I'm not sure. Anybody else have thoughts about this? Dan?
From what little I've read about kind of that culture and that hermit experience, a lot of these people were bureaucrats. We had very busy political and social lives that would become hermits to kind of reground themselves after balance their lives. I don't know about kind of the monastic probably different.
Yes, that was the so there was in China there was the practice of Taoism and Confucianism, and you would be a Confucian during your social life, and then you would be in a Taoist when you went off on your own. And there was a balance between that. You'd be a Taoist, you'd go off and be a hermit, you go back and be a bureaucrat. Sometimes you'd just be a Taoist forever, but you would have been a Confucian first. So that relates to what you're talking about, Dan. Somebody else? Yeah, Greg.
Karen Stone used to say that we sit with others, Bringing up that point that a lot of our difficulties are with the social and sort of managing our reaction to that. So I don't know about the experience.
Meaning the Hermit experience would be lacking that?
Right.
What fun would that be? I don't know. Yeah.
I think maybe the Hermits had imaginary friends.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I think maybe the Hermits had imaginary friends. I always had imaginary friends. Plenty of social interactions with them. So
Okay.
Do you think it would be appropriate or possible for us to, as a community here, have the kinds of things that are available to people in a 12-step environment or a therapeutic environment practiced right here?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we could evolve to that. I mean, whether we evolve to that, I think American Zen actually ultimately needs to evolve to that in some way or other. Yeah. But what form that would take, or that would be... I mean, Zazen still is our main activity. It has to be our main activity because of the focus or of how hard it is, how much effort it takes to let go of our attachment to our stories. But I could see a healthy Zen center having a whole complement of things, of practices. But you know, whether that's for us now or in 20 or 30 years, I don't know. But yeah, why not? What would be the disadvantage? The disadvantage would be that you can only do so many things. That would be the disadvantage. And we're small, and I'm just trying to get people to sit. I mean, you know, and I'm hoping they take care of their affiliative needs, their attachment needs outside. I'm hoping, but. Yeah, it's a good question. Good question. Yeah.
It occurred to me that the balance of the call and made it completely necessary for both.
Yep.
Yeah.
You want to say something more about that?
Yeah. Well, just the idea that you have to have your own personal experience so that then we also have that. That's the one that you have a way of.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. Anybody else?
Matt's comment.
Okay.
Called to mind for me the Oxford Richards.
Yeah.
I know that's true of hermits too, that a lot of times it's part of the tradition to be a hermit for so long and then come back and
Yes. And of course, the Japanese Zen is very focused on that. There'd be an essential part of Japanese Zen, the way Katagiri and Suzuki taught it. Yeah.
How long do you want this question and answer period to continue? Because I can jump in as another.
Oh, it's 10-2. We can do another 5 minutes. Is that what it is? 10-2? Yeah, we can do another 5 minutes.
Well, I'm going to just start it anyway then.
So
you were asking questions about how could the community allow these situations of abuse to develop.
Yeah.
I've been reading works by Gene Sharp, who's a social and political theorist, about nonviolent action as a way of transforming societies from dictatorships into democracies. And apparently his ideas have been part of this whole process going on in Egypt and Morocco and all of northern Africa, and not only there. But one of the things he says is that in a dictatorship, and this is where we're coming to the teacher, the spiritual community, the dictatorship manages to hollow out and eliminate all of these little civil institutions within a society, so that there's basically this focus. Basically everything comes
top. Yeah, yeah.
And so Sharpe's essays and works are aimed at reconstructing these necessary elements of democratic society.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing stuff to read. And I guess that's all I want to say. Oh, no, one more thing. And that is, so he uses this, the story of the little boy you asked him, which we said, but the king's not wearing any clothes, as an example of kind of a fable that can help people realize that they're living in this situation which is just no longer tenable. But the story he uses, I think, is another Japanese fable. And it's about a man who had enslaved a bunch of monkeys. And every day the monkeys would go out into the jungle and gather coconuts and bananas. And they had to give 10% of whatever they got back to the man. Stockpiled them, and he had this enormous piles of bananas and coconuts. And then one day, one of the little monkeys said, "Wait a minute. Did the man plant those bananas or those coconut trees?" "No, he didn't." "Well, why do we have to give him any of this stuff then?" Anyway, and the monkeys realized all instantaneously, we don't have to. So they went and grabbed all the bananas and coconuts back from the man and refused to give them to him.
I see. Thank you. Well, the implication of that is that over the next 50 years, and this takes a while, we need to explore different forms of spiritual community in Zen in America, different ways. And I'm looking forward to being part of that for as long as I can. Thank you all.